From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is the ER. This week, we look at North Korea from the vantage point of a troubleshooter, a man who has gone into Pyongyang to meet representatives of both Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un, the father and the son, to negotiate the release of American captives over the years.
1-2, 1-2, 1-2.
That is Bill Richardson. He made his first trip to North Korea in 1994. He was a congressman then from New Mexico. He's gone back 7 times since. Most recently, he was involved in efforts to bring home Otto Warmbier, the college student from University of Virginia. Richardson's also a former UN ambassador and a former governor of New Mexico. And we're speaking to him at this unique moment, after North Korea's release of 3 American detainees and before a scheduled summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Governor Richardson, thank you for joining me. I wanted to start with the basics. What does it feel like to land in North Korea on a mission to free American captives?
Well, first you arrive in North Korea and you're not told anything. You're whisked into a bus, into your limousines, and you go to a safe house, which is very plush, where you're staying. They don't tell you a thing until an official handler comes in and then hands you the schedule. This is who you're going to meet. And this is when you negotiate with the North Koreans. Look, I don't want to meet this person. I don't want to go to this statue. I've seen it. This is the agenda. This is what we want to do. So they go back. A day goes by. And then you start negotiating with the North Koreans. They don't think like we do. They have a different definition of a quid pro quo. They believe that their authority comes from the deity, from the father, the grandfather, now Kim Jong-un. Their idea of a concession is to let you arrive at their point of view, but they'll give you some time. They won't necessarily agree to your point of view. They're very formal, they're relentless, they're organized. You never make a deal with a North Korean sitting across a table. That's taken up by them venting, their talking points, their official position. The way you make a deal with a North Korean is the way I have on American pilots, prisoners, remains, food issues, is you do it on the sidelines. You do it after you've built some trust at a meal. You do it outside the formal negotiating process. When you're in North Korea, you're totally under their control. You can't walk outside. They take you around. They show you who, what they want you to see. They, you meet with whoever they want. Sometimes that's broken when you say, "Well, I came to talk about, nuclear issues. So I want to see the nuclear negotiator." They take you to a lot of cultural events. They take you to a lot of tourist events. They take you to hardly ever take you out to meet ordinary people. You make certain requests. I used to always want to go to the subway because I'd see how people interacted, how they lived. They never encourage you to talk to anybody outside official channels. Like if you suddenly move up and talk to somebody on the subway, they'll kind of find a way to break that up.
I actually wanted to go back first to 1994 when 2 pilots are downed, 1 dies, and you happened to be there at the time you were a congressman. And President Bill Clinton asked you to stay and negotiate the release of Bobby Hall, who had lived. Tell us about that moment, because it seems to me that actually was one of the entry points for your diplomacy.
Well, that was my entry point for diplomacy, the fact that as a member of the House Intelligence Committee, I had been approved by the North Koreans, the first of many congressmen, to come to North Korea, to enter into a dialogue. And the moment I arrived in North Korea at the airport, it was a very cold, bleak day, I get into the official car taking me to my guest residence, and I'm informed by the North Korean that there's a development happening and that the Secretary of State and the President wanted to talk to me when we got to the guest facility. So I remember going in and the President and Warren Christopher at the time said, "Congressman, your mission has changed in North Korea. Two American pilots were shot down. We'd like you to stay and bring them home. You will have our full support. I said, well, I don't see any of you around here. And please undertake this effort on behalf of the government. You're the only link that we have. At the time, we didn't have Swedish representatives. You know, we had no relationship. So that got me into almost a three-week effort to try to get them out. Persuasion, meetings. They would let me hang out there without any news until finally.
Wait, you stayed on the ground for 3 weeks?
In North Korea? I was 2.5 weeks. Wow. And it was inching towards Christmas. And I think one of the factors that got the two pilots released, one was released that died. Bobby Hull was released on an agreement that if I left, he would be released shortly thereafter. Was that I threatened the North Koreans. I said, well, I'm not going to leave until the two pilots are released. And that was generating a lot of bad publicity for the North Koreans. You know, this congressman's here. He's trying to get the North Koreans out. And there was an internal debate within the North Koreans as to whether they should give me the pilots or not, because they wanted money in exchange. They wanted some kind of ridiculous concessions. Finally, I said, well, I'm not leaving. And I think they got sick of not just my staying there and sick of me. But they finally, right before Christmas, and I was about to leave because I said, you know, some other negotiation is needed. And I remember one of the North Korean officials coming in and saying, okay, you have to go back with somebody. One of your pilots died. We didn't know that. And we will give you the pilot's body in a formal ceremony, and Bobby Hall will be released, before the end of the year. This was like close to Christmas. I said, all right, can we make that a public commitment? And they made a public commitment. And so that's how I first got involved in hostage negotiations. Right after that, I was involved in an effort with Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, trying to get her out of prison into house arrest. That succeeded. That started my relationship with Aung San Suu Kyi. And shortly thereafter, there was the release of the two American contractors I got out of Iraq from Saddam Hussein, where I was almost an official envoy as a congressman of the Clinton
administration. And you actually sat down with Saddam Hussein for that?
I did, yes. We sat down for 2 hours and we got the two Americans out. A very tense but interesting meeting.
What's changed in North Korea since that first release? That was 1994. Now we're in 2018. Right. Obviously now we're with the son, not the father. But what else has changed?
Well, first, the mode of leadership. I think Kim Jong-un has a different vision than his father. The father was kind of a rug merchant in terms of negotiations. He would say, you know, we'll release this American, but we want a high-level visit in return, somebody asking us to release. So President Clinton, President Carter, even I would get a prisoner in exchange for a visit. But what I always saw was a regime very much in control, supported by the people, at least the official people, the military, the foreign policy establishment, very tight controls over the population, very strong discipline. You know, these are people that are suffering, that are, many looked hungry, but they don't see an outside world. What I noticed in my last visit to North Korea, they still have that program television where the state is extolled, Kim Jong-un is extolled, the Americans are the bad guys, the Pueblo incident, we beat the Americans, we're, you know.
Explain the Pueblo incident.
The Pueblo incident was when North Koreans captured a ship, an American ship, and kept a lot of their crew members, Navy members, captured. And they show that battle, and they have in Pyongyang the old Pueblo, the actual ship. And
it's
used as a museum to extol the victory of the North Koreans over the Americans. And of course, they distort what happened. And what they show you the cruelty of the United States in film, and that's ingrained in the mind of many North Koreans.
Did Secretary Pompeo reach out to you before he went in for this negotiation?
Well, he didn't reach out to me before the negotiation, but we had a very, what I consider, productive conversation recently, in fact, 2 days ago. I commend Pompeo on the North Korea issue for three reasons. One, for opening a channel with the North Koreans through his intelligence CIA sources. That was good. That's the best channel we've had, it seems, in terms of producing results. Number two, in going to North Korea twice, meeting with Kim Jong-un and establishing a personal relationship, and perhaps for those reasons, a summit might take place. I think it will eventually take place. Pompeo seems to be the most realistic in terms of describing the message of the Trump administration with North Korea. The problem with the Trump administration, they have too many messengers on North Korea, too many spokesmen, too many threats, too many insults, including the president. Pompeo seems to be the one that is emerging as somebody that the North Koreans trust. And I would recommend to the administration that they let Pompeo be the only vehicle for communicating with the North Koreans instead of having so many other players. You know, when the president says they're committing to full denuclearization, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. That's his goal. But by him constantly pushing that, that is, you know, that is not helpful. And then the administration also in their Sunday shows saying that the reason the North Koreans have come to the table is because of pressure, economic pressure, sanctions. You know, why say that? I think the North Koreans have come to the table for several reasons. One, Kim Jong-un wants to stay in power. He wants a security guarantee that we won't knock him off. Two, he wants sanctions lifted, reduced, especially by the Chinese. Three, he wants an end to the Korean War, which is the armistice agreement. Technically, we're still at war, so that he can negotiate with the United States a reduction in military forces with South Korea. The North Koreans have always wanted to negotiate with us directly. And that's a goal that they're getting for the summit. Summit with the President of the United States. So that's what I think Kim Jong-un wants. And then lastly, I think eventually his deal is he will trade off his nuclear and missile activity, some of it, for economic assistance from the West.
If Trump pushes for full denuclearization, will the summit fail?
Yes. I think he should push for it, but realize that it's not going to happen. First of all, not at the first meeting. You know, I've even heard the administration say, well, before the summit, they have to fully denuclearize. They're not going to do that. And this is the problem that is emanating today from North Korean statements.
Are you surprised by the shift in North Korean position and asking for, you know, an end to? Why can't the South Koreans and Americans just hold off on exercises, for example?
Well, I think first the administration and the South Koreans, they should just cool it. Just wait for the summit. Just stop making threats. Stop making statements and that they're going to break down and go with full denuclearization. That, you know, the North Koreans, what they've done recently is they feel that they've made some positive gestures. They released the three Americans. They announced that they're going to destroy this nuclear site. They said it's okay for the U.S. and South Korea to continue some military exercises. They did say that. Now, when they hear the United States response, which is, the North Koreans are acting because of our pressure. You know, so the North Koreans are saying, we're doing all the nice things. They're flexing their muscles a little bit. This is a negotiating tactic of theirs. I believe in the end they will go to the bargaining table and the summit will happen.
So bluster is something you don't want in going into the North Korean negotiating table. What are the qualities you need in a good negotiator for sitting down with Pyongyang?
Well, first, we need the president to understand that he needs to build a personal relationship with Kim Jong-un. And the way to do that is take him aside at the summit, talk to him at a meal, take a walk with him, build trust. He has full power in North Korea. That is essential. These are very relentless, proud people that happen to have at least 40 nuclear weapons. They're not, you know, some low-powered military country.
Do they look at something like walking away from the Iran deal and say, why should we sit down with a country that just broke a deal?
The North Koreans read every single statement emanating from the United States. They are news junkies. They watch every TV show. The Iran decision of the president was not helpful because it cast doubt with the North Koreans on, one, the word of the president of the United States and the United States, and secondly, they look at the example of Libya and Iraq, other countries that gave up their nuclear weapons, and where are they? But lastly, it shows to them that from one president to another, America might not keep its word. So why should we give up any serious nuclear weapons and make a deal with a country that may break it sooner?
I want to go to a question, a humanitarian question. You talked about the remains. Right. The families of former servicemen come to your foundation and ask for you to negotiate for the remains. Can you go into that a little bit? How many are we talking about? What does that look like? And what is the hope of those families?
Well, in 2007, the North Koreans came to me and said, we want to resume the recovery program of remains of soldiers. This was part of the U.S.-North Korea relationship, where the North Koreans would return remains of American soldiers from the Korean War. Some say there's about 5,000 in the North Korean mountains remains that happened. So the North Koreans came to me and they said, as a gesture of goodwill, we're going to give you, Governor Richardson, seven remains. And we're not going to charge you. And we'll have a proper ceremony. We'll identify them also. So they gave me seven remains, and I informed the Bush administration. They gave me an Air Force plane and other delegation members, and we received those seven remains in the DMZ. What the North Koreans were saying is, we want a reciprocal gesture, which was basically to say, we'll resume the program in which the Department of Defense pays the North Koreans for each set of remains. So it's foreign exchange to the North Koreans. But the North Koreans have they want a good military relationship with the United States, the North Korean military. And I've said to the administration, I said, I think the North Korean military, we should engage them. I don't think they're to the right of the leader. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're hardliners. I think they realize that in a military situation, they're vulnerable. And so they're on the peace negotiating side. Don't cast them as you know, the hardliners that want to go to war. That's been my experience in dealing with the North, and I pass that on to the administration.
The idea of a tiny gesture is really interesting to me. So I understand that there was a moment in the Otto Warmbier negotiations where maybe a note would have helped. How do those small gestures help the North Koreans?
I know the North Koreans, they care a lot about, they're very formal. They want letters signed by high officials. Little notes, you know, with the official stationery, friendly notes without much substance. They appreciate those gestures, and they're very formal. They don't like to be personally insulted. Personal. Like, I remember one time I was in North Korea, and this was the time President Bush referred to Kim Jong-il, the father, as a dwarf. And I remember hearing from the North Koreans, you know, this was like a terrible insult. I said, well, you know, I didn't say it, but let's put that aside. And this is when I think the Rocket Man and, you know, insults like that were not helpful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the president likes to say, well, that's what got him to the negotiating. That's not the case. What got the North Koreans to the negotiating table is, I think, interventions by the South Koreans that want peace. They want a dialogue with North Korea, the Olympic gesture by the South Korean president, the summit between the North and South. And I think Kim Jong-un's view that he had finally reached his military strength and potential, and now he was ready to negotiate. I think we underestimated Kim Jong-un, and he has got a vision. He's unpredictable. You got to watch him every step of the way. They're going to cheat. But I think it's best, and one of the reasons I've been supportive of President Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un is we've never had negotiations with the North from the top to the bottom. And I've been involved in this issue where you have special negotiators, low-level people moving up. That hasn't worked. And I haven't seen the peninsula so tense and so full of potential conflict. And this summit all of a sudden has reduced tensions.
Has there ever been a moment in your mind where you're nervous for your own safety? Yeah.
Well, there were a couple of times. My first visit, when I was left alone in isolation, I said, well, you got to get back to me on releasing the Americans? Yeah, we'll get back to you. One day would go by. I mean, I had all this plush surrounding. 2 days would go by and nothing would happen. I was so frustrated, I asked one of my handlers, look, I need to go into town. You guys are driving me crazy by leaving me alone here. What, don't you have everything you need? Food, wine? I said, yeah, that's fine, but I need to go out. And I was driven into Pyongyang, the center of town. And while I was driven out, Secretary Christopher called and thought I'd been kidnapped because I wasn't around.
Oh,
and I came back, and this is the only time he got mad at me. He said, Congressman, you know, don't ever do that again. I said, what? He said, don't ever leave the house. I said, no, I'm going crazy here. Well, you got to notify me. I said, well, it's a little difficult to notify you. And, you know, and then in that first visit, there's some unforgettable moments. I got the two pilots out. Well, we got one of them out, and one was coming out. And the North Koreans said, this is their strange way of negotiating, but they were serious. Well, you have to pay us, you, the United States, for the ammunition that we shot these pilots down. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And they said, why not? I said, well, you shot them down, but they were violating our skies, our laws. I said, well, I'm not going to pay you for that. And so a compromise was, I said, okay, you've talked to Secretary Christopher a lot, the U.S. I mean, they monitored everything. And I said, okay, how much is the long distance cost? And they said, $10,000. And we did pay it. And I had a military guy with me, U.S. military. We did pay it, cash.
When you were there in that very first trip, though, you were talking about nuclear issues, but also humanitarian issues. And that's something it feels to me is a bit lost from all of this, the actual situation, the humanitarian situation on the ground in North Korea for North Koreans.
Yeah.
Are we going to get back to that?
Well, I think the ideal scenario is for the president and Kim Jong-un to engage in a first historic talk that focuses on nuclear issues, but then establish a process over the next few years where a range of issues are discussed, humanitarian issues, human rights issues. I don't think American businesses and international private sector operations are going to want to go into North Korea without a notable improvement in the human rights situation of the individual North Korean people. And I think Kim Jong-un realizes that. So you have to have human rights issues, the remains of our soldiers, no more detentions. Look at the gulags that exist, prison reform, establishing North Korea. If they want to be part of the international community, it just can't be on business issues. They have to sign the Geneva Convention, human rights conventions.
Do they want to be a part of the international community?
I believe so. I think Kim Jong-un does. I think that's his goal. I mean, we'll see. This is why that personal relationship that has to be established between the two presidents is so important. My worry is that the president, we're going to have two formal sessions. I hope the summit takes more than one day. I see it's just one day where there's social time, where they get to know each other.
In each situation, do you try to pinpoint that moment that allows you to break through the kind of big asks you knew you were going in for? How do you find that one thing that allows you to chip in to find out, okay, this person's a parent and he wants something for his child or something else? How do you figure that moment out and when does it happen?
Well, the first rule of negotiating with me is you've got to relate to your adversary personally. You have to respect them. You've got to know what that person makes them tick. You read a lot about the person, but you read a lot about who are the last people that have talked to him, his current situation. You don't care about his revolutionary past. You care about the mindset right now. And then you show respect. You listen. You vent. I always feel that you go to their site for the negotiation. You know, many negotiators say, no, we got to negotiate where we meet. It should be here in the United States. I said, no, you want to, I'll come to Iraq. I'll come to Sudan. That's an easy concession because it gives the other side a sense that you've respected them and that you're conscious of their issues. And then you got to let the other side save face and find ways that they get some credit, that they're getting something out of the negotiation, when in effect, the only thing may be a praise is for a humanitarian gesture. Like Saddam Hussein said, well, if I release these three, can I get a better relationship with the United States? I doubt it. You'll get maybe 3 days of good press, and I'll thank you. Well, will Clinton thank me? I said, I don't think so. And he still did it because they had, you know, they had kept these prisoners for 6 months. He still did it. So he figured he might find a way to get some goodwill by the release of the two Americans to me. So, but I had built a relationship with him at our meeting. You know, we had a stormy, contentious relationship with Saddam Hussein. You know, he came in, tried to intimidate me. He had all his guards and, you know, I remember my hands were sweating, and then I made a big mistake. I was talking to him, and I showed him the soles of my shoe.
Oh.
And that, to an Arab, is a total insult. And he walked out of the room. And I remember asking Tariq Aziz, you remember him, his mm-hmm. foreign minister?
Yeah.
I said, is he coming back? Am I toast? What's going on? He said, no, he'll be back, but you should apologize. And he came back, and I decided not to apologize, but I was very respectful. I said, no, I think he thought I was weak and was going to slobber. Oh, I'm so sorry, culturally inept that I showed you. And I said, I went in and I said, look, you need to release these people. Look at their families. And he kept looking at me saying, this guy is crazy not to apologize to me. Because he had walked out and he came back. And then in the end, you know, he released him. And I remember, you know, we had built sort of a little personal connection. And he was this far from me. And when he says, he takes a piece of paper and says, on behalf of Article 7 of the Iraqi Constitution, I hereby release the two Americans to Congressman Richardson, and they will be released. Right when he was saying release, I grabbed his hand like, hey, thank you. And all of his guards swarmed in. They thought I was going to assassinate him.
Oh, God.
I said, no, I just... And so we got up, you know, stood up. And he says, well, you know, I'm going to have the press come in. And then he says to me, Saddam, he says, well, you know, taking my picture with you is not helpful to me and my people. And I said to him, well, Mr. President, my picture with you is not helpful to me either. And he kind of smiled. But then the press swarmed in. And, you know, about an hour later, we just sat around and he brought the three prisoners in.
A final question. Trump has floated the idea he should be up for the Nobel Peace Prize. What do you think?
Well, I think that's, first of all, something has to happen for him to deserve this. Nothing's happened yet except a lot of good words. I give him credit for agreeing to the summit and you know, the preparations so far for the summit, but that's highly premature. Let there be a positive result and maybe he'll be considered. I think he's got a lot of other areas where he's not acting like a Nobel Prize winner. But, you know, I think that talk is premature, and it bothers North Koreans because it implies that he has done all the spade work and the good work. I mean, you know, the South Korean president probably is in contention. Kim Jong-un probably thinks he deserves it. So, you know, this Nobel Prize talk is not helpful.
Governor Richardson, thank you so much for taking the time to meet with us today. It's been an honor and really, really fascinating.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I've been your host. The podcast is produced by Shelby Bosted. For more information about foreign policy and to subscribe to The ER, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.